That's Jimmy Smith taking the lead on organ with The Sermon, the title track of the 1958 album. He's backed up by a group of illustrious sidemen, Lee Morgan on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Tina Brooks on tenor sax, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Wednesday, June the 18th. And two stories for your consideration today. In the second half of the program, internationally renowned scholar and author Tariq Ali gives us a sweeping context, historical and political context, for the events unfolding now in Iraq and in the region. But first, we go to Tallahassee, Florida, where there is a showdown going on even as we speak. Next Wednesday, the Senate will be taking on a hearing. The Senate Judiciary Committee will be holding a hearing on restoring voting rights protections that the U.S. Supreme Court had shot down last summer when it said that certain sections of the Voting Rights Act were unconstitutional. But today in Tallahassee, faith healers from all over Florida have converged on the state capitol for a face-off with the state's Board of Executive Clemency, seeking to restore the voting rights of an estimated 1.5 million ex-felons barred permanently from voting because of their criminal past. Florida has the largest population, about 25% of the nation's 6 million citizens who have lost their voting rights because of felony convictions, but is one of only three states besides South Carolina and Tennessee that permanently revoke such rights. We are joined by representatives of a group called People Improving Communities for Organizing, or PICO. It is an interfaith organization staging its second legislative intervention today on the issue. And we're joined first by Reverend Gregory James, who is the pastor at Life Church International Center in Tallahassee. Thank you, Reverend James, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be a part of this show today.
Thank you, sir. Well, in honor of you, I started off with The Sermon by by my favorite organist, jazz organist. But why are you in Tallahassee today? What's happening today? What is the engagement going on there today?
Today is the second meeting of the Clemency Board, which hears from men and women who are seeking to have their rights, civil rights restored, the rights restored, and our presence is so important because it's very adamant that we make our presence known and our voices heard, that men who have served their time, that have paid their debt to society, should be given their rights back. The process is one that makes us feel and know that relief has been granted, but access has been denied. So when we look at what happened in 2008 under the former administration of Charlie Crist, automatic restoration of rights, and under this new administration, there are no automatic restoration of rights. It's a period of waiting for over 13 years. It's just unjust and it's unconstitutional. So our voice today is the voice that says we must give men and women their rights back after they paid their debt to society.
Now, it is almost unbelievable that Florida alone accounts for one quarter of 6 million citizens whose voting rights have been revoked permanently, and that Florida should be one of three states that has these provisions. What has the reception been today? You talked to the Board of Clemency, and they have a very strange process in which the governor and three members of the board essentially are the ones primarily responsible for making the change. What is the reception today?
Well, I mean, the reception today is getting better. It's not where we want it to be. In the month of March, around the 19th, we were here for the first time for the first meeting, and there were clergy, there were leaders from all over the state that emerged inside the Clemency Board. We also had the opportunity to have a meeting with the Attorney General, as well as some of those board members, to discuss what our beliefs were, what we felt, the right for men and women to be in their rightful place as restored citizens that are returning back again. So the climate is changing. Eyes are becoming open. Ears are being open to the fact that it's necessary for them to relook at what has happened with them redoing what was done in 2008. So we're in a process of definitely reforming the Clemency Board agenda.
Do you see anything happening in time for, say, the November election this year?
Well, I feel that the November election that is coming up will not actually bring about the kind of change that we want as far as what happens with the rules that are in place now. But it will give us an opportunity to look those on the board to make these decisions, because everyone who's sitting there, from the governor to the attorney general to the commissioner of agriculture, will be up for re-election. So if it means changing that whole board, then we change the whole restoration process, because that board governs men and women coming out of prison being able to get their rights. So could it possibly be a change in that board? It very well can be. If men and women who have family members incarcerated, urge them to get out and vote, and vote for people who believe in a second chance, then there is the possibility that we will see change immediately.
Could you address the question, Reverend James, about the disproportionate impact this has on people of color in the United States?
Well, I mean, when you look at it, I mean, people of color are impacted in a great way. I mean, you know, you're limited. One of the most important things that a man wants when he's released from prison is the opportunity to be able to provide for his family, be able to provide in a way whereby he's productive again, and without having the opportunity for the job employment, without being able to gain gainful employment, it affects him, it affects the community, it affects our state as a whole. And when that happens, it puts a person who's returning, a returning citizen, in a position to survive. And survival sometimes costs in ways that they will not appreciate, but it's a survival mode. So it affects us in a major way where we cannot access to what has been made.
According to the Sentencing Project, which has been monitoring this issue, the project says that one in every 13 African-American adults cannot vote as a result of felony convictions. And in three states, in Florida, Kentucky, and Virginia, it is more than one in five that is disfranchised this way. Why is it this something of a national crisis? Why don't we see this as a huge call to arms here on this question?
Well, I mean, you know, voting is the key to changing of policies, changing of legislation. And I just feel that the disenfranchisement that is taking place is a political agenda that is in place that keeps those who are returning from prison back into society from the process of voting, because it's through the power of the vote that things are changed. And once we understand what we've gone through as men and women who have been incarcerated, and once we understand the values, the voice that's behind our vote, then we're able to go in and vote our heart and our conviction.
LaShana Tyson is with the organization in People Improving Communities for Organizing of Florida, and she has been directly affected by this issue. Welcome, LaShana, to the program, and tell us how you have been affected and why are you involved in this
Go down and come around.
Hi.
Yes, we're hearing.
Hello?
Yes, we're hearing you.
Okay, I didn't know if you can hear me or not. Thank you for having me. My name is LaShana Tyson, and I got into this work because I recently served 13 years in prison. And when I came home, I didn't ask for too much. I only wanted to do a couple things, go back to college, get somewhere to live, and get a couple jobs, and that's all I wanted. Then when I came home, I couldn't go back to college. I couldn't get a job. When the door to college was closed to me, I said, well, I'll just go and work, you know, get two jobs, because I worked hard in prison and I worked for free. So I know I can work really hard out here and get paid for it. That's when I realized that I was discriminated against legally because of my felony conviction. I would fill out numerous applications and nobody would contact me. They would never, I never heard anything. I never got an interview, never anything.
Well, here's a tough question to you, LaShana. Some would say, well, look, this is the price that people who commit serious crimes, this is the price they have to pay. What is your response to that?
My response to that is, that's not the price. When you have to pay the price this way, it becomes everyone's price. Because when you release a person back into society with no means and no hopes and no dreams of becoming a better person by being able to get a job, being able to go back to college, go back to school, further their education, being able to get somewhere to live, you leave them no other option but to continue to commit more crime. So it just doesn't continue to punish the person who's been convicted of a felony. Society is at risk at the same time. Because if you don't have anything, like I did in my case, I came home after 13 years, I didn't have anything. Anything. That's a long time. Any belongings that I had, they were long gone. But it was just, I was blessed to have supportive family, and I didn't have to go that route. And I'm blessed because God is he's orchestrating my steps right now. I really believe in God. I really love God for what he's doing right now with me. But you have, if you're going to release these people back into society, you have to provide them with a way to take care of themselves. Because if you don't, you're just creating that cesspool of more victims of crime, more victims going in and out of the prison system.
As you see the situation today, are you encouraged by the turnout today in Tallahassee?
I'm encouraged anyway. But yes, I have become more encouraged throughout this last year, because I started fighting last January, not knowing what it was going to lead to. I just started fighting because I spent 13 years in prison, and I watched the system at work. I watched these women get out and come right back, get out and come right back. And at the time, I didn't understand why they were coming back. I thought they were addicted to drugs or something. It is because they can't get jobs out here. They can't take care of themselves or their kids. They can't make it out here. So I am very hopeful, and I see the changes that we make when we go
and protest at the clemency board. I saw that the very first time.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you, Reverend James, for being with us. We'll follow this issue, of course, because it is affecting 6 million people across the United States. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Well, we'll take this we won't take the break. We actually are running short on time, and I want to get to this piece. We talked earlier this week about the issue of Iraq placed in perspective, and we see that when these events are related to us as people in the public looking to media to inform us, we get a very distorted and very narrow view. I want to introduce you to Tariq Ali. A major scholar. He's leftist, of course. but he, with surgical precision, places the current crisis in perspective. And here is the kicker, and I want you to keep this in mind as you listen to this. He delineated this 10 years ago. 10 years ago, this is how he analyzed the situation unfolding in Iraq and the role of the West in shaping, or in his terms, recolonizing Iraq. Here he's speaking to students at Binghamton College, Binghamton University, I should say, in 2004. And this is just after his book had come out. The book pertinent to this discussion was titled Bush in Babylon, The Recolonization of Iraq. And he gives a very interesting analysis from the Arab interpretation of reality, as opposed to the Western interpretation of reality. But it is extraordinary how precise his analysis is 10 years ago. And when you listen to this, you go, my God, if people had this clarity about the situation 10 years ago, what excuse does the United States or Britain or any other foreign government have for saying that they don't understand it, or that the media would have to say, well, they understand it, but in very narrow context. So I present Tariq Ali. I hope we can get through this part of the tape. But please keep in mind again, 10 years ago, this is how he saw it. Tariq Ali.
6 months before the war on Iraq began, a whole group of people, different parts of the world, warned of the following things in debating those who were ready to go to war, both in this country and in Britain. The first thing we said was that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. There was absolutely no evidence for this. The second thing we said was that Saddam Hussein had no links with Al-Qaeda. He may have had many other defects, but he had no links with Al-Qaeda. He had no weapons of mass destruction. At that time, these views were constantly attacked in the mainstream media. The Economist, editorial after editorial, saying these weapons are dangerous and they threaten the Western world. The New York Times didn't believe he had links with Al-Qaeda, but was absolutely convinced he had weapons of mass destruction. Likewise, the Washington Post. Likewise, the LA Times. Likewise, the Murdoch Empire. Likewise, virtually every mainstream newspaper in this country and quite a few in Britain. Now, that in itself poses a massive problem for the functioning of democracy. When the media becomes such an essential pillar in the waging of war, that propaganda is presented as news and there is no independent investigative journalism in a large bulk of the mainstream press. And what is the situation today? Today, it's public knowledge that there aren't weapons of mass destruction. And if there are a few Al-Qaeda activists there, they weren't there during the time of Saddam, but they've been encouraged there by the occupation that is taking place. That's another small irony. So why did the politicians lie to go to war? Because their lies have cost the people of Iraq dear. Often in the Western world and in the Northern Hemisphere, the lives of those who live in the South don't count for much. And the fact that there are between 11,000 to 12,000 Iraqi civilians and soldiers have died in this war means nothing. The figures we get are 600 US soldiers who've died, 3,000 seriously wounded US soldiers, probably double that number who've been wounded, between 2,000 and 3,000 who've been withdrawn because they've had mental breakdowns, nervous breakdowns in Iraq, because they were not prepared for the hostility of the population. These are bad figures. But all I say is, don't separate them from the Iraqis who have died already and are dying every single day. Now, when they went to war, it's obvious, if you study what they said, that they were not prepared for a resistance. They thought they would take Iraq, which we all knew they would because of such superior military power and technological power. No one doubted that the United States would capture Iraq. But what we warned them about, in public, in the press in Britain, that there would be a resistance, that this wasn't some tiny little Balkan province. This was a sovereign, independent Arab state with a history of resisting occupations, with four insurrections against the British Empire from the 20s to the 50s, four big insurrections and many minor ones. And that regardless of what people thought or didn't think of Saddam Hussein or whether he was popular or hated, regardless of that fact, the occupation would not be welcomed by the people of Iraq. And yet, the great thinker president thought that they would be welcomed with sweets and flowers. Now, why did they think this? They thought this because they were told this by a group of tame Arabs who work for them, the House Arabs of the American Empire. Fuad Ajmi, Kenan Makia, this whole gang, told them, please go, the people of Iraq are waiting. They've been waiting for a long time, and you will be greeted with sweets and flowers, the exact phrase used by these people in the White House. Now, one reason they said that is they may have believed it. Another reason they said that is because that is what the principals of the war wanted to hear. That's what Cheney, Rumsfeld, Pearl, Wolfowitz wanted to hear, that this is how they would be welcomed, that they were going to liberate an Arab country. Well, that didn't happen. And that began to, and that shocked them. It stunned both the soldiers in the field who had been briefed, and it stunned the politicians. And quite interestingly, you had a very rapid development of an armed resistance in Iraq, which began to score hits and casualties virtually the second week after the occupation. And even those who didn't join the armed resistance made it clear, as the British deputy consul in Iraq said to BBC television, I have absolutely no doubt that the bulk of the people of Iraq loathe this occupation. Well, thank you. A bit late now. When we tried to tell you this before you went in, you didn't listen. And you accuse people who oppose the war of being apologists of Saddam Hussein. So what do we have now when it's become clear that the reasons given to the populations and the citizens of Britain and the United States to go to war were falsehoods? Manufactured falsehoods. When the intelligence agencies couldn't come up with the right answers, they were put under heavy pressure by the politicians. By Downing Street in London, by the White House staff here, we want information which helps us to go to war. That's what they said. But okay, so you've taken Iraq and you still can't find the weapons. And finally, on Meet the Press, not so long ago, the great thinker president was asked, well, where are the weapons of mass destruction? Why did you go to war? And he said, oh, well, you know, the weapons are neither here nor there. Basically, he said, Saddam Hussein is a madman. That's what he said. Now, for the President of the United States to explain to a large television audience that the reason he went to war in Iraq is because Iraq is run by a madman sets a very dangerous precedent. Think about it. I mean, who's to prevent any state from deciding that another state is run by a madman? And by mad, you mean people who act irrationally, lie, are paranoid. So it's not a clever thing to say. But one could have asked, and the journalist should have asked him, could you explain to us, Mr. President, when exactly Saddam Hussein's mental health deteriorated? Which year was it? Which month? If you want to say he was a madman when he used chemical weapons against the Kurdish population of Halabja, that was when he was a close ally of the West. You didn't stop him. You even vetoed a resolution condemning the attack on the Kurdish village in the Security Council. And Tony Blair refused to vote against it when a motion was presented in the House of Commons. Or was he a madman when he went to war against Iran? How could he be? He was armed, given enormous amounts of support, weaponry, by every single Western country. So that couldn't be when he was a madman. He became a madman when he decided, for reasons of his own, to break with the West, which wasn't of his own making, but that's another story. So to explain world politics in terms of madness and good and evil doesn't help anyone, because it doesn't help a population to understand what's going on in that part of the world. So basically, we now know from Paul O'Neill's memoirs, as written by Ron Susskind in a best-selling book, that they had decided that they wanted to go after Iraq in week two of the Bush administration, well before 9/11. They were determined to take Iraq, and O'Neill describes how a number of people at that crucial meeting were discussing oil, were discussing strategic priorities, were saying this is a government which didn't do the United States bidding, and it would be good to stabilize the Middle East if we had every government doing our bidding. That's when they decided to go to war. After 9/11, it became impossible to resist because of those events, and they manufactured evidence, and they went to war. Now, what amazes me always is how detached citizens in the West have become from history not to have understood that there would be a resistance in Iraq. No one in the Arab world doubted it for a moment. And when 4 months into the occupation, Paul Wolfowitz, one of the masterminds of the war, arrived in Baghdad and gave a press conference, and he was asked, well, how do you explain the security situation? How come that the security situation is so bad? And Wolfowitz said, you know, there is a big problem in Iraq. I accept that. Do you know what it is? And the journalist said, what is it? He said, there are too many foreigners coming into Iraq. He wasn't referring to the U.S. Army. He wasn't referring to two-thirds of the British Army, which is back in the old bases they used to occupy in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. He wasn't referring to the Poles, the Bulgarians, the Ukrainians, the Japanese. He was referring to other Arabs coming in from neighboring Arab countries to help fight the resistance. That's how twisted people can become and not understand why there is a resistance taking place in Iraq. And how does this link to the war on terror? The so-called war on terror was initially designed to crush Al-Qaeda, an organization at most of 2,000 to 3,000 operatives in different parts of the world. And they said that they would go to war against Afghanistan to defeat Al-Qaeda, destroy it completely, and bring back Osama bin Laden dead or alive. Remember the words? Bring him dead or alive. And they said that they'd pinpointed where he was, and they announced this. And then when 2 weeks later troops arrived at the caves at the foothills of the Pamir Mountains in Afghanistan, they were surprised to find that there was no one there. You announce in public you're going to kill him. You say you're going to bomb the caves into oblivion. And then you arrive and he's not there and you're surprised. The other guy they said they were going to find in Afghanistan was Mullah Omar, the leader of the pro-Osama faction inside the Taliban. That was the other big person they were after. Now, with the biggest surveillance techniques the world has ever known, where from a satellite you can see what's going on in a country almost. And they said they had him targeted, which isn't difficult because this is a guy who's got a very bad leg. He limps and he's got one eye. War-wounded guy, so it's not difficult to pinpoint him. But they couldn't find him either. And they reported that when last seen, he was on a motorbike heading towards the desert. Unlike Steve McQueen in The Great Escape, Mullah Omar got away. He actually got away. No one knows where he is. Osama still hasn't been found. Al-Qaeda left its base in Afghanistan and moved elsewhere. And the regime imposed on Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, one of the old worker agents for the agency, the Central Intelligence Agency, made Prime Minister of Afghanistan, who is so aware of the hostility to him that he doesn't trust a single Afghan to form part of his bodyguard. You have US Marines guarding him nonstop, which doesn't all go well for either his own future or the future of the country on which he's been imposed. And I've always felt it would be far better to pull him out as soon as possible. He has these lovely shawls and he could parade as a model in Paris or New York. Don't keep him there because his life is unfortunately limited. Sooner or later someone will get him. Because people don't like being occupied. However awful their governments are, they prefer consciously and subconsciously to deal with these governments themselves. So the big problem which confronted the United States after 9/11, what to do, they blew it, basically. They blew it. Is the world safer from small groups of terrorists because of what's happened subsequently? I don't think so. I don't think so. The only way in which the world could be made safer is if you understood, if the U.S. administration understood, that the key task is to stop the flow of recruits to groups like that. And you can only do that by understanding what the political problems are and trying to reach political solutions. You cannot do it by waging wars. And the two key questions in the Arab East were the continuing sore of Palestine, the sanctions regime against Iraq, which had wrecked that country and weakened its population and made the population more dependent on the state than it had ever been before, and the weekly bombing raids, Anglo-American bombing raids on Iraq, which went on for 12 years, that by the end of those raids, Pentagon officials were telling the New York Times, we've run out of targets in Iraq, we don't know what to bomb. And this was a country which supposedly posed a threat. Just doesn't make sense. And as the whole world knows now, if Saddam Hussein had had weapons of mass destruction, they would never have invaded. Like North Korea, a much weaker country than Iraq, but he does possess them, and said he would use them if his country was invaded. And immediately diplomacy came into play. So they knew he didn't have them. That's why they went in. That is precisely why they went in. They knew it was a weak country with a weak army which could be taken quickly. But the situation in that part of the world has now become worse. Because one of the things they did after 9/11 was to abandon all attempts at serious negotiations in the Middle East, either with Iraq or in the Palestine-Israeli conflict. Sharon became a valued ally in the war against terror. Putin in Russia became a valued ally in the war against terror. A guy who has virtually destroyed Chechnya, razed the Chechen capital Grozny to dust, killed between 20 and 30,000 Chechens. There were 1,800 deaths in Kosovo, remember? 1,800 after NATO began bombing, not before. And in Chechnya, between 20 and 30,000. And these double standards are noticed by people in most parts of the world. And what they realize is that great empires, powerful empires, and this applies to them all, historically have always acted in their own interests. They don't act in the interests of anyone else. And the national security, the national strategy doctrine of the Bush administration makes that very clear if you read it. We will defend what we consider our interests by any means necessary, including the use of force to preserve U.S. hegemony. That's what they say, and that's what Iraq is about, a display of imperial power, which also helps get control of the oil, which is an added bonus. It wasn't just the oil. It was a display of imperial power to show that at the beginning of the 21st century, we could take a country and remold it according to our own needs and our own desires. And after we had done that, we would move towards dealing with Iran and Syria. Well, Iran and Syria are lucky, because that's not going to happen now. Because if there was an attempt to invade Syria and Iran, there would be a rebellion within the Pentagon. Because these are the guys who've got to carry out these instructions, and they know what the situation on the ground is. I don't know whether you're aware, but there have been three showings of a classic anti-colonial film, Pontecorvo's Battle of Algiers, in the Pentagon. Not normally a venue for seeing old art house movies. But they've been seeing it because the movie is very revealing. And it shows that even when the French succeeded in clamping through terror, crushing the rebellion in France, the battle would be won some years later by the Algerians. And that is going to be the case here too. So what then is the way out? I think the way out is to demand an end to the occupation, to give the Iraqi people now what they are demanding, which is their own, they will elect their own constituent assembly without a foreign presence, because that foreign presence is inhibiting, and this constituent assembly will frame a new constitution, and they will then vote. Now, people say when you say that, oh, yeah, but now if we withdraw, won't there be a mess? I say, excuse me, there is a mess. Just look at what's happening every single day in Iraq. Every single day. There's a big mess. There are acts of violence all over the country, including now in the south. So this is something which is not going to die down. And it's true, immediately after the withdrawal, different groups will jockey for power, but they are also quite capable, as they've done in the past when they defeated the British, of working closely together. And we will see what comes out of it. The one thing which is very clear is that the occupation isn't working, however much they try and conceal it. They captured Saddam Hussein. First, we were told the resistance was being masterminded by Saddam Hussein. When you saw photographs of this pathetic guy captured, I think most people understood that he couldn't have been masterminding anything. Then he was captured. Then they said, now the resistance will end because we've got the head guy. We argued at that time, far from the resistance ending, many who were reluctant to join the resistance because of Saddam Hussein would now join it. And that's exactly what's beginning to happen in different parts of Iraq. And nowhere, no other Arab country has agreed to send troops or to help them because they know it's suicidal. Marked difference to the first Gulf War. So this is an occupation which is becoming untenable by the day. And I think it's a real tragedy that whereas in other parts of the world, when you had the big mobilizations on February the 15th, they did have a big impact on their politicians. In Britain, when we had 1.5 million people out on the streets, the result was 80 Labour members of Parliament voted against the war. The tragedy is that in the United States, the Democrats were so aloof at that time from the mood amongst a section of the population, mainly their own supporters or potential supporters, that they didn't come out against the war. And so we now have an ironic situation in this country where the only Democrat who came out against the war is no longer in the running, and where all the other candidates voted for the war. So what price democracy? That's the tragedy. The dissent in the United States, opposition in the United States, which is no different from opposition elsewhere in the world, but the difference is that here it isn't reflected either in mainstream politics or in the mainstream media. That is not the case in Europe. Blair would like it to be the case, which is why he's trying to curb the BBC. Because he comes here, he sees what a slavish press Bush has, and he goes to Russia, sees how Putin controls the press, and then he often goes to Italy, where Berlusconi owns everything. And he says, what have I done to deserve the BBC? So he's trying to crush it. He's trying to crush it. But it isn't working. There's a big backlash developing there too. But you see, as a result of the massive opposition in the British population to the war, we had two big broadsheet newspapers, The Guardian and The Independent, opposed to the war. We had a tabloid newspaper, The Daily Mirror, savagely opposed to the war. We had the BBC forced to reflect dissident opinions throughout the war. They cut it down, but they couldn't keep us off the air. That makes an enormous difference. Here it was not like that. And I know there are wonderful indie media networks, etc., which are great. But they don't make up for the fact, and they can't because of the lack of money and power, of the control which the networks have in this country. So that's a big, big problem. A big problem. And it's ironic that since the collapse of communism, democracy itself has begun to go on the decline, almost as if it was the threat of communism which forced them to put on a brave show. Now they don't need to. You can do what you want. So the Washington Consensus, which rules the world or tries to rule the world, always had two legs. The neoliberal monster didn't just walk on one leg, the economic leg. It had another leg, the military leg, which it said it would use when it had to, and it did. It's used it in Iraq. But in terms of moving towards the world...
Tariq Ali speaking at Binghamton University on February the 19th, 2004. And it's as if he was reading a crystal ball. But it's not because he was extraordinarily insightful. It is because he is drawing from documented history, an understanding of history, and an understanding of the culture, an understanding of the world. He's not coming from this perspective that, you know, this world dominant country that's all obsessed with its particular interests and nothing else. But listen to what he said. More than anything else that has been fueling the rebellions in that part of the region is a reaction to occupation. The United States posits it as a move to, as President Obama has said, as President Bush has said, and even President Clinton, who initiated the Iraq Liberation Act, which was the impetus for Bush's adventurism in Iraq later on in 2003, the notion that they're bringing democracy to the world and everybody is grateful for the blessings of the United States brought to them by the, you know, the strength of bombs and guns and tanks and bullets and troops and misery and death. And even today, there is no indication that whether a Democrat is in the White House or a Republican is in the White House or even in the congressional delegation as a whole in the House and in the Senate, there is no indication of a willingness to depart from the twisted attitudes toward foreign policy. So there isn't any hope that people could have that that attitude will change. What can change is opposition to it. You heard him say about the Democratic Party. This is, he's talking, folks, I remind you, 10 years ago. He says the Democratic Party, that is the party that one would have expected vigorous opposition to a Republican president's misadventures in Iraq, that the Democratic Party basically never posed any real opposition. They were, as he called it, unhinged from their own political base. Because people have, in the end, the party has an interest in winning. It's very, very narrow interests. They are not looking toward succeeding generations and how actions basically have long-term consequences. That's not what they're about. They want to win. They want to capture the House. They want to capture the Senate. They want to capture the big prize of the presidency. But this is the observation of the scholar. And I thought it was so incredibly on point. It gives us another way of looking at this. This is not to say we condone any of this. Nobody would condone this kind of, this intense level of violence. Nobody in their right mind would condone that. But it is important to understand how these things can and do happen and will happen, because the foundation is carefully orchestrated so that they will happen. And we are discussing this very complex issue. The media would be discussing it in very, very fundamental, simplistic ways, with a complete absence of the historicity of the region, of the country, of the culture, even of U.S. involvement in foreign policy. We can only deal with about 48 hours worth of history at a time. And so when we heard from Professor Beeman on Monday about the role of the British in artificially creating this country in the first place, and that was, by the way, through spying and through covert action and through warfare, the partitioning of a country and creating these artificial borders and cramming people who have no cultural history with each other together simply because, well, it works for them. These are the discussions that we have to insist that our leaders engage in, but they're not intellectually ready for it. They're not really equipped to deal with this level of discussion. That's unfortunate, but it is important for us to get an insight. And I hope that this little talk by Tariq Ali, T-A-R-I-Q, Ali, gives you a reason to reconsider this whole question that we're dealing with now as a crisis, as yet another crisis, and that it gives us another dimension to appreciate as we observe the unfolding of events. Thanks so much for joining me today. Keep it right here. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus. Drop me a note and let me know whether this program is resonating with you. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with Hutrice Lead on Facebook. Thank you so much. A pleasure and indeed a great privilege to be in your company.